Chapter 4. Grotto. Small can be beautiful. An eagle may at times go hungry. A pet canary, never. Dejnev, Sr. 16. In a large and well-lit washroom, Boronova and Dejnev began to remove their outer clothing. Morrison, alarmed at the prospect, hesitated. Boronova smiled. "You may keep your underclothing on, Dr. Morrison. Just toss everything else, except your shoes, into that bin. I presume there is nothing in your pockets. Place your shoes at the base of the bin. By the time we leave, it will all be cleaned and ready for use." Morrison did as he was told, trying not to observe that Boronova had a most opulent figure, concerning which she seemed totally unaware. Amazing, he thought, what clothes will obscure when not designed to reveal. They were washing now, with lavish application of soap, faces to the ears and arms to the elbows, then brushing savagely at their hair. Again Morrison hesitated, and Boronova, reading his mind, said, "The brushes are cleaned after each use, Dr. Morrison. I don't know what you may have read of us, but some of us understand hygiene." Morrison said, "All this just to go into the grotto? Do you go through this every time?"
"Every time.
That's why no one goes in just briefly. And even when staying within, there are frequent ablutions. You may find the next step unpleasant, Dr. Morrison. Close your eyes, take a deep breath, and hold it if you can. It will take about a minute." Morrison followed orders and found himself strongly buffeted by a swirling wind. He staggered drunkenly and collided with one of the bins. He held on tightly. Then, as suddenly as it started, it was over. He opened his eyes. Dejnev and Boronova looked as though they had put on fright wigs. He felt his own hair and knew he must look the same. He reached for his brush.
"Don't bother," said Boronova. "There's more we'll have to go through."
"What was that all about?" said Morrison. He found he had to clear his throat twice before he could speak.
"I mentioned that we'd have the dust vacuumed away from us, but that's only the first stage of the cleaning process. Through this door, please." She held it open for him.
Morrison emerged into a narrow but well-lit corridor, the walls glowing photoluminescently. He lifted his eyebrows. "Very nice."
"Saves energy," Dejnev said, "and that's very important. Or are you referring to the technological advancement? Americans seem to come to the Soviet Union expecting everything to be kerosene lamps." He chuckled and added, "I admit we haven't caught up with you in every respect. Our brothels are very primitive compared with yours."
"You strike back without waiting to be struck," said Morrison. "That is a sure sign of an unclear conscience. If you were anxious to demonstrate advanced technology, I could point out that it would be very simple to pave the avenue going from Malenkigrad to the grotto and to use closed air jets. We would need less of this." Dejnev's face darkened, but Boronova put in sharply, "Dr. Morrison is quite right, Arkady. I don't like your feeling that it is not possible to be honest without being rude. If you cannot be both honest and polite, keep your tongue on your own side of your teeth." Dejnev grinned uneasily.
"What have I said? Of course the American doctor is right. But is there anything we can do when decisions are made in Moscow by idiots who save small bits of money without counting the consequences? As my old father used to say, the trouble with economizing is that it can be very expensive."
"That's true enough," said Boronova. "We could save a great deal of money, Dr. Morrison, by spending on a better road and better air jets. But it is not always easy to persuade those who hold the purse strings. Surely you have the same trouble in America."
She was motioning even as she talked, and Morrison followed her into a small chamber. As the door closed behind them, Dejnev held out a bracelet to Morrison.
"Let me tie this around your right wrist. When we hold up our arms, you hold up yours."
Morrison felt his weight lighten momentarily as the chamber floor dropped.
"An elevator," he said.
"Clever guess," said Dejnev.
Then he clapped a hand to his mouth and said in a muffled tone, "But I mustn't be rude." They stopped smoothly, and the elevator door opened.
"Identification?" came a peremptory voice.
Dejnev and Boronova raised their hands, at which Morrison did as well. Under the purplish light that suddenly suffused the elevator, the three bracelets glittered in patterns which were not, Morrison noted, exactly alike. They were ushered down another corridor and into a room which was both warm and damp.
"We will have to have a final scrub down, Dr. Morrison," said Boronova. We are accustomed to this, and stripping is routine for us. It is easier and time-saving to do it as a group.
If you can stand it, said Morrison grimly, I can.
It is unimportant, said Deshneff. None of us are strangers to the sight.
Deshneff scrambled out of his underclothes, stepped over to a portion of the wall where a small red knob was glowing, and placed his right thumb immediately above it. A narrow panel in the wall slid open and revealed white garments hanging flaccidly to one side. He placed his underclothes at the bottom. He seemed utterly unabashed about being nude. His chest and shoulders were dark with hair, and there was a long-heeled scar on his right buttock. Morrison wondered idly how that might have come about. Boronova did the same as Deshneff had done, and said, Pick a light that is on, Dr. Morrison. It will open to your thumbprint, and then, when you touch it again, it will close. After that, it will open only to your thumbprint, so please remember your locker number, and you won't have to press every locker in order to find your own. Morrison did as he was told. Boronova said, If you need to use the bathroom first, you can go there.
I'm all right, said Morrison.
With that, the room was a swirl with a damp mist of water droplets.
Close your eyes, called out Boronova, but it was unnecessary for her to say so. The initial sting of the water forced his eyes closed at once.
There was soap in the water, or at any rate something that stung his eyes, tasted bitter in his mouth, and irritated his nostrils.
Lift your arms, called out Deshneff. You needn't circle, it comes from all directions.
Morrison lifted his arms. He knew it came from all directions. It came from the floor, too, as you could tell by the slightly uncomfortable pressure on his scrotum.
How long does this last? He gasped.
Too long, said Deshneff. But it is necessary.
Morrison counted to himself. At the count of 58, it seemed to him that the bitterness on his lips ceased. He squinted his eyes. Yes, the other two were still there. He continued to count, and when he reached 126, the water stopped, and he was bathed in uncomfortably hot and dry air. He was panting by the time that stopped, too, and he realized he had been holding his breath.
What was all that for?
He said, looking away uncomfortably at the sight of Boronova's large but firm breasts, and finding little comfort in Deshneff's hairy chest.
We are dry, said Boronova. Let's get dressed.
Morrison was eager, but was almost immediately disappointed by the nature of the white clothes in the locker. They consisted of a blouse and pants of light cotton, the pants held by a cord. There was also a light cap to cover the hair and light sandals. Though the cotton was opaque, it seemed to Morrison that little or nothing was truly left to the imagination.
He said, Is this all we wear?
Yes, said Boronova. We work in a clean, quiet environment at even temperature, and with throwaway clothes we can't expect much in the way of fashion or expense. Indeed, barring a certain understandable reluctance, we could easily work in the nude. But enough, come.
And now at last they stepped into what Morrison recognized at once as the main body of the grotto. It stretched away before him, between and beyond ornate pillars, to a distance he couldn't make out. He could recognize none of the equipment. How could he? He was entirely a theoretician, and when he worked in his own field, he used computerized devices that he had designed and modified himself. For a moment, he felt a stab of nostalgia for his laboratory at the university, for his books, for the smell of the animal cages, even for the stupid obstinacy of his colleagues. There were people everywhere in the grotto. There were a dozen nearby and others farther off, and the impression was of the interior of a human anthill, crawling with machinery, with humanity, with purpose. No one paid any attention to the newcomers or to each other. They went about their work in silence, their steps muffled by their sandals. Again Boronova seemed to read Morrison's mind, and when she spoke it was in a whisper, We keep our counsel here. None of us knows more than it is good for him, or her, to know. There must be no leaks of significance.
But surely they must communicate.
When they must, they will, minimally. It reduces the pleasure of camaraderie, but it is necessary.
This kind of compartmentalization slows progress, said Morrison.
It's the price we pay for security, said Boronova. So if no one talks to you, it is not a personal matter. They will have no reason to talk to you.
They'll be curious about a stranger.
I have seen to it that they know you are an outside expert. That is all they need to know.
Morrison frowned. How can they expect an American to be an outside expert? They don't know you're an American. My accent will give me away at once, as it did to the serving woman. But you will not talk to anyone except for those to whom I will introduce you.
As you wish, said Morrison, indifferently.
He was still looking around. Since he was here, he might as well learn what he could, even if it should turn out to be trivial. When, if he returned to the United States, he would surely be asked for every detail he had observed, and he might as well have something to give them. He said in Boronova's ear, "This must be an expensive place. What fraction of the national budget is expended here?"
"It's expensive," said Boronova, admitting nothing further, "and the government labors to limit the expense."
Dezhnev said sourly, "I had to work for an hour this morning to persuade them to allow a small additional experiment for your benefit. May the committee catch the cholera?" Morrison said, "The cholera no longer exists, even in India. May it be reinstated for the committee." Boronova said, "Arkady, if these supposedly humorous expressions of yours get back to the committee, it will do you no good."
"I'm not afraid of those pigs, Natasha."
"I am. What will happen to next year's budget if you infuriate them?" Morrison said with sudden impatience, but speaking even more softly, "What concerns me is neither the committee nor the budget, but the simple question of what it is I am doing here."
Dezhnev said, "You are here to witness a miniaturization and to be given an explanation of why we need your help. Will that satisfy you, comrade outside expert?"
17. Morrison followed the other two to something that looked like a small, old-fashioned train carriage on very narrow-gauge tracks. Boronova placed her thumb on a smooth patch, and a door slid open smoothly and without noise.
"Please get in, Dr. Morrison."
Morrison held back. "Where are we going?"
"To the miniaturization chamber, of course."
"By railroad? How big is this place?"
"It is large, Doctor, but not so large. This is a matter of security.
Only certain individuals can use this device, and only by using it can one penetrate into the core of the grotto."
"Are your own people so untrustworthy?" "We live in a complex world, Dr. Morrison. Our people are trustworthy, but we do not wish to subject large numbers to temptations they need not face. And if someone persuades one of us to go elsewhere, as we have persuaded you, it is safer if their knowledge is limited, you see. Please get in."
Morrison entered the compact vehicle with some difficulty. Dezhnev followed him with equal trouble, saying,
"Another example of senseless cheese-pairing. Why so small?"
"Because the bureaucrats spend billions of rubles on a project, and they feel virtuous if they save a few hundred in odd places at the cost of making hard-working people miserable."
Boronova got into the front seat. Morrison could not see how she manipulated the controls, or for that matter, if there were controls to manipulate. It was probably controlled by a computer. The carriage began to move suddenly, and Morrison felt the slight backward jar that resulted. There was a small window at eye level on either side, but not of clear glass. Morrison could see a small section of the cavern outside in a streaky, wavy, poorly focused manner. Apparently, the windows were not meant for vision, but were merely intended to reduce what might otherwise be an unacceptably tight enclosure to those with claustrophobic tendencies. It seemed to Morrison that the individuals he could make out through the glass paid no attention to the moving carriage. "Everyone here," he thought, "is well trained. To show any interest in any procedure with which you have nothing directly to do must apparently be a sign of discourtesy, or worse." It seemed to Morrison that they were approaching the wall of the cavern, and the carriage, with another small jerk, slowed. A section of the wall slid aside, and the carriage, with yet another jerk, picked up speed and moved through the opening. It grew dark almost at once, and the dim light in the carriage's ceiling did little more than change night to dusk. They were in a narrow tunnel into which the carriage fit with apparently little room to spare, except on the left side, where Morrison, peering past Dezhnev, thought he could make out another pair of rails. There must be at least two such carriages, he thought, with room to pass one another in the tunnel if both were in operation. The tunnel was as dimly lit as the carriage, and it was not straight. Either it had been carved through the hill in such a way as to follow lines of least resistance in order to save money, or it was curved deliberately in some dim, atavistic search for making things more secure by making them more complicated. The darkness inside and outside the carriage might serve the same purpose.
How long will this take? Asked Morrison.
Dezhnev looked at him with, in the dimness, an unreadable expression.
You don't know how to address me, I see. I do not have an academic title, so why not call me Arkady? Everyone does here, and why not? My father always said, what counts is the person, not the name.
Morrison nodded. Very well. How long will this take, Arkady?
Not long, Albert,
said Dezhnev cheerfully, and Morrison, having been lured into first-name informality, could not object to the return. He surprised himself a little by finding he did not wish to object. Dezhnev, even with his father's aphorisms included, seemed to be uncomplicated at least, and under the circumstances, Morrison welcomed a chance of refraining from the perpetual fencing match to which Boronova seemed to subject him. The carriage could not be moving at a speed faster than a leisurely walk, but there was a small lurch each time it took a curve on the track. Apparently, petty economies included leaving the curves unbanked. Then, with absolutely no warning, light flooded in, and the carriage ground to a stop. Morrison blinked as he stepped out. The room they were now in was not as large as the one they had left, and there was virtually nothing in it. There were only the tracks under the carriage that made a wide arc and then led back toward the section of the wall from which they had emerged. He could see another small carriage disappearing into the opening and the wall closing behind it. The carriage in which they had arrived made a slow circuit of the arc and came to rest near the wall. Morrison looked around. There were many doors, and the ceiling was comparatively low. Without definite evidence of the fact, he felt that he was in a three-dimensional checkerboard, with numerous small rooms on several levels. Boronova was waiting for him, seeming to observe his curiosity with a touch of disapproval. Are you ready, Dr. Morrison?
No, Dr. Boronova, said Morrison. Since I don't know where I'm going or what I'm doing, I'm not ready. However, if you will lead the way, I will follow.
That is sufficiently ready. This way, then. There is someone else you must meet. They passed through one of the doors and into another small room. This one was very well lit and had its walls lined with thick cables. In the room was a young woman who looked up when they came in, pushing aside something that seemed from its appearance to be some kind of technical report. She was quite pretty in a pale and vulnerable way. Her flaxen hair was cut short, but with enough of a wave in it to keep her from looking too severe. The scanty cotton uniform she wore, which Morrison already knew to be universal within the grotto, showed her to be attractively slim and shapely enough, though without Boronova's opulence. Her face was marred, or perhaps enhanced, according to taste, by a tiny mole just under the left corner of her mouth. Her cheekbones were high, her hands thin-fingered and graceful, and her expression did not appear as though she were much given to smiling. Morrison smiled, however. For the first time since his kidnapping, it seemed to him that there might be a lighter side to this dismal situation in which he had been unwillingly plunged.
"Good day," he said. "It's a pleasure meeting you."
He tried to give his Russian an educated sound and to get rid of what the serving woman had so easily detected as his American accent. The young woman made no direct answer, but turning to Boronova, said in a voice that was slightly husky,
"Is this the American?"
"It is," said Boronova. "He is Dr. Albert Jonas Morrison, professor of neurophysics."
"Assistant professor," said Morrison, deprecatorily.
Boronova ignored the correction. "And this, Dr. Morrison, is Dr. Sofia Kalinin, who is our electromagnetics expert."
"She scarcely looks old enough," said Morrison gallantly.
The young lady did not seem amused. She said,
"I look perhaps younger than I am. I am 31 years old."
Morrison looked abashed, and Boronova cut in quickly, "Come, we are ready to begin. Please check the circuits and set matters in motion. And quickly." Kalinin hurried out. Dezhnev looked after her with a grin.
"I'm glad she doesn't seem to like Americans. It cuts out 100 million potential competitors, at least. Now, if she also didn't like Russians and would come to realize that I am as Kirillo-Finnish as she is..."
"You, Kirillo-Finnish?" said Boronova, forced into a smile. "Who would believe that, you madman?"
"She would, if she were in the proper mood."
This would require an impossible mood. Boronova turned to Morrison. Please do not take Sophia's behavior personally, Dr. Morrison. Many of our citizens pass through an ultra-patriotic phase and feel it to be very Soviet to dislike Americans. It is more pose than reality. I'm sure once we begin to work together as a team that Sophia will let down her barriers. I understand completely. Things are similar in my country. As a matter of fact, at the moment, I'm not very fond of Soviets, and understandably, I think, but... And he smiled. I could make an exception for Dr. Kalinin very easily. Boronova shook her head. American like you, a Russian like Arkady, there is a peculiar masculine way of thought that transcends national boundaries and cultural differences. Morrison was unmoved. Not that I will be working with her, or with anyone. I have grown tired of telling you, Dr. Boronova, that I don't accept the existence of miniaturization, and that I cannot and will not be of assistance to you in any way. Dezhnev laughed. You know, one could almost believe Albert. He speaks so seriously. Boronova said, Observe, Dr. Morrison. This is Katinka. She tapped a cage, which Morrison, startled, now observed for the first time. Dr. Kalinin had rather absorbed its attention till now, and even after she had left, he had been idly keeping his eye on the door through which she had gone, waiting for her reappearance. He focused on the cage of wire mesh. Katinka was apparently a white rabbit of moderate size and placid appearance, who was munching away at greenery with a rapt concentration of her kind. Morrison was aware of the slight scrabbling noise she made and of the rabbit odor, which he must have noted unconsciously earlier and ignored. He said, Yes, I see her. A rabbit.
Not just a rabbit, Doctor. She is a most unusual creature. Unique. She has made history to a far greater extent than has the catalogue of war and disaster that usually is thought of by that name. If we exclude such purely incidental creatures as worms, fleas, and submicroscopic parasites, Katinka is the first living creature that has been miniaturized. In fact, she has been miniaturized on three separate occasions and would have been miniaturized dozens of times more if we had been able to afford it. She has contributed enormously to our knowledge of the miniaturization of life forms, and as you can see, her experiences have in no way adversely affected her. Morrison said, I do not wish to be insulting, but your bare statement that the rabbit has been miniaturized three times is not really evidence that this has indeed happened. I do not mean to cast doubt upon your integrity, but in a case like this, I think you understand that nothing less than witnessing the fact is sufficiently convincing. Certainly. And it is for that reason that, at considerable expense, Katinka will now be miniaturized a fourth time. 18. Sophia Kalinin swirled back in and turned to Morrison.
Are you wearing a watch, or do you have anything metallic on you? She asked crisply.
I have no possessions on me at all, Dr. Kalinin. Nothing but the clothes I wear, the single pocket of which is empty. Even this identification bracelet that has been put on me seems to be of plastic.
It is merely that there is a strong electromagnetic field and metal would interfere.
Morrison said, Any physiological effects?
None. Or at least none have yet been detected.
Morrison, who was waiting for them to give up their pretense of miniaturization and wondering how long they could carry on the fraud, he was growing more censorious over the matter by the minute, said with just a touch of malice, Might not overexposure lead to birth defects should you ever get pregnant, Dr. Kalinin? Kalinin flushed.
I have a baby. She is perfectly normal.
Were you exposed during pregnancy?
Once.
Boronova said,
Is the Inquisition over, Dr. Morrison? May we begin?
You still maintain that you will miniaturize the rabbit?
Certainly.
Then go ahead. I'm all eyes. How foolish of them, he thought sardonically. They would soon be claiming, of course, that something had gone wrong, but where would they go from there? What was it all about? Boronova said,
To begin with, Dr. Morrison, would you lift the cage?
Morrison made no move to do so. He looked from one to the other of the three Soviets in suspicion and uncertainty. Dezhnev said, Go ahead, it won't hurt, Albert. You won't even get your hands dirty, and after all, hands were meant to become dirty at work. Morrison put his hands on either side of the cage and lifted. It weighed about 10 kilograms, he judged. He grunted and said, May I put it down now? Of course, said Boronova.
Gently, said Kalinin. Do not disturb Katinka.
Morrison lowered it carefully. The rabbit, which had momentarily stopped feeding when the cage was lifted, sniffed the air curiously and returned tentatively to its unhurried chewing. Boronova nodded, and Sophia moved to one side of the room where a bank of controls were all but hidden by the cables. She looked over her shoulder at the cage as though estimating its position, then walked over to move it slightly. She returned to the controls and closed a switch. A whining sound made itself heard, and the cage began to glitter and shimmer as though something, all but invisible, had interposed itself between it and themselves. The shimmer extended beneath the cage, separating it from the stone-topped table on which it had been resting. Boronova said, "The cage is now enclosed in the miniaturization field. Only the objects within the field will be miniaturized." Morrison stared, and a little worm of uncertainty began to stir within him. Were they going to try some clever illusion on him and make him think he had witnessed miniaturization? He said, "And how exactly did you produce that so-called miniaturization field?"
"That," said Boronova, "we do not intend to tell you. I think you understand what classified information is."
"Go ahead, Sophia."
The whine heightened in pitch and intensified somewhat. Morrison found it unpleasant, but the others seemed to endure it stolidly. In looking at them, he had taken his eyes off the cage. Now, when he looked at it again, it seemed to have grown smaller. He frowned and bent his head so as to line up one side of the cage with the vertical line of a cable on the opposite wall. He held his head steady, but the side of the cage shrank away from the reference line. There was no mistake. The cage was distinctly smaller. He blinked his eyes in frustration. Boronova smiled narrowly. "It is indeed shrinking, Dr. Morrison. Surely your eyes tell you so?"
The whine continued, the shrinking continued. The cage was perhaps half its original linear measurement. Morrison said, with obvious lack of conviction, "There are such things as optical illusions." Boronova called out, "Sophia, stop the process for a moment." The whine lowered into silence, and the glitter of the miniaturization field dimmed and died. The cage sat on the table as before, a considerably smaller version than it had been. Inside was the rabbit still, a smaller rabbit, but one that was proportioned in every way as the original had been, munching on smaller leaves, with smaller pieces of carrot distributed across the floor of the cage. Boronova said, "Do you honestly think that this is an optical illusion?" Morrison was silent, and Deshnev said, "Come, Albert, accept the evidence of your senses. This experiment consumed considerable energy, and if you remain unconvinced, our clever administrators will be annoyed with all of us for wasting money." "What do you say, then?" And Morrison, shaking his head in rueful confusion, said, "I don't know what to say."
Boronova said, "Would you lift the cage again, Dr. Morrison?" Again Morrison hesitated, and Boronova said, "The miniaturization field has not left it radioactive or anything like that. The touch of your unminiaturized hand will not affect it, nor will its state of miniaturization affect you. You see?" And she placed her hand flatly and gently on top of the cage. Morrison's hesitation was not proof against that. Gingerly, he placed his hand on either side of the cage and lifted. He exclaimed in surprise, for it could not be much over a kilogram in mass. The cage trembled in his grip, and the miniaturized rabbit, alarmed, hopped to one corner of the cage and huddled there in agitation. Morrison put the cage down, and as nearly as he could estimate, did so in its original position. But Kalinin walked over and made a small adjustment. Boronova said, "What do you think, Dr. Morrison?"
"It weighs considerably less."
"Is there some way you pulled a switch?" "Pulled a switch? You mean replaced the larger object with a smaller, while you were watching? The smaller exactly like the larger in everything but size? Dr. Morrison, please."
Morrison cleared his throat and didn't press the point. It lacked plausibility even to himself.
Boronova said, "Please notice, Dr. Morrison, that not only has the size been decreased, but the mass in proportion.
The very atoms and molecules of which the cage and its contents are composed have shrunk in size and mass. Fundamentally, Planck's constant has decreased, so that nothing inside has changed relative to its own parts. To the rabbit, itself, its food and everything within the cage seems perfectly normal. The outside world has increased in size relative to the rabbit, but of course it remains unaware of that.
But the miniaturization field is gone. Why don't the cage and its contents revert to ordinary size?
For two reasons, Dr. Morrison. In the first place, the miniaturized state is metastable. That is one of the great fundamental discoveries that makes miniaturization possible. At whatever point we stop in the process, it takes very little energy to maintain it in that state. And secondly, the miniaturization field is not entirely gone. It is merely minimized and drawn inward so that it still keeps the atmosphere within the cage from diffusing outward and normal molecules outside from diffusing inward. It also leaves the walls of the cage touchable by unminiaturized hands. But we are not finished, Dr. Morrison. Shall we continue?
Morrison, troubled and unable to deny the direct experience, wondered for a moment if he had somehow been drugged into a kind of super-suggestibility that would make him experience whatever he was told he was experiencing. In a choked way, he said, "You are telling me a great deal."
"Yes, we are, but only superficially. If you repeat this in America, you will probably not be believed, and nothing you say will give the slightest hint as to the core of the miniaturization technique." Boronova lifted her hand and Kalinin again threw the switch. The whine returned, and the cage began once again to shrink. It seemed to be going faster now, and Boronova, as though reading Morrison's mind, said, "The further it shrinks, the less mass there is to remove, and the more rapidly it shrinks further." Morrison found himself staring in a state of near shock at a cage that was a centimeter across and still shrinking. But Boronova raised her hand again, and the whine died. "Be careful, Dr. Morrison. It weighs only a few milligrams now, and it is a fragile object indeed to anyone on our scale. Here, try this." She handed him a large magnifying glass. Morrison, without saying a word, took it and held it over the tiny cage. He might not have managed to make out what the moving object within it was if he had come upon it without prior knowledge, for his mind would not have accepted such an incredibly tiny rabbit. He had seen it shrink, however, and he stared at it now with a mixture of confusion and fascination. He looked up at Boronova and said, "Is this really happening? Do you still suspect an optical illusion, or hypnotism, or what else?
Drugs?"
"If it were drugs, Dr. Morrison, it would be a greater achievement than miniaturization. Look around you. Doesn't everything else look normal? It would be an unusual drug indeed that would alter your sense perception of a single object in a large room of unchanged miscellany. Come, Doctor, what you witnessed is real."
"Make it larger," said Morrison breathlessly.
Dezhnev laughed and suppressed in a quick choke. "If I laugh, the wind may well blow away Katinka, whereupon Natasha and Sophia will both strike me with everything else in this room. If you wish it enlarged, you will have to wait."
Boronova said, "Dezhnev is right. You see, Dr. Morrison, you have witnessed a scientific demonstration, not magic. If it were magic, I could snap my finger and the rabbit would be its normal self again in a normal cage, and then you would know you are witnessing an optical illusion. However, it takes considerable energy to decrease Planck's constant to a tiny fraction of its normal value, even over a relatively small volume of the universe, which is why miniaturization is so expensive a technique. To enlarge Planck's constant once again must result in the production of energy equal to that which had been consumed originally, for the law of conservation of energy holds even in the process of miniaturization. We cannot deminiaturize, then, any faster than we can dispose of the heat produced, so that it takes considerable time to do it, much more than it took to miniaturize." For a while, Morrison was silent. He found the explanation involving conservation of energy more convincing than the demonstration itself. Charlatans would not have been so meticulous about obeying the constraints of physics. He said, "It seems to me, then, that your miniaturization process can scarcely be a practical device.
At most, it would only serve as a tool, perhaps, to broaden and expand quantum theory. Voronova said,
Even that would be enough. But don't judge a technique by its initial phase.
We can hope that we will learn how to circumvent these large energy changes, how to find methods of miniaturization and deminiaturization that will be more efficient. Does all the energy change have to pass from electromagnetic fields into miniaturization, and then into heat on deminiaturization? Might not deminiaturization be somehow inveigled into releasing energy as electromagnetic fields again? That would be easier to handle, perhaps.
Have you repealed the second law of thermodynamics? Asked Morrison with exaggerated politeness.
Not at all. We don't expect an impossible 100% conversion. If we can convert 75% of the deminiaturization energy into an electromagnetic field, or even only 25%, that would be an improvement over the present situation. However, there is hope of a technique even more subtle and far more efficient. And that is where you come in. Morrison's eyes widened.
I know nothing about this. Why pick me out for your salvation? You would have done as well with a child out of kindergarten.
Not so. We know what we are doing. Come, Dr. Morrison, you and I shall go to my office while Sophia and Arkady begin the tedious process of restoring Katinka. I will there show you that you know quite enough to help us make miniaturization efficient, and therefore a commercially practical venture. In fact, you will see quite clearly that you are the only person who can help us.